It's time again for the one show that takes a look at business from a different perspective, the coaching perspective, with Master Certified Business Coach, Doug Gefeller. Hey, Doug.
Hey, Paul. Well, here we are again, another great show ready to start.
I'm telling you, you're getting a fantastic lineup, and I've heard this woman speak who is on next, and she is right up your alley. She's fantastic.
She is good, and it's taken a while to nail her down because she travels some, but hey, we are very lucky. Our topic for today is your brain on leadership. You know, technology advancements are made daily, but when is the last time a significant advancement was made in the field of leadership? Well, the field of neuroleadership is hardening up the traditional soft stuff and providing us with research that is showing good indication of being the field that will move the needle on leadership. So we're going to explore this today with Jennifer McCusker, Director of Global Talent Management and Retail HR at Oakley. Jennifer, welcome to the Coaching Perspective Show.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, I'm so thrilled to have you here. I was fortunate to hear Jennifer a few months ago talk at an ASTD presentation. I said, we've got to get her on the show. And so I appreciate you making room in your schedule for us, Jennifer.
Absolutely.
Well, look, tell our audience a little bit about your background prior to Oakley. What did you do before?
Sure, absolutely. Well, I really started my career in academia, where I received a PhD in organizational psychology, and I've been really fortunate to have worked for a wide variety of companies and industries. It's one of the beauties of the field that I'm in, organizational development. It's people-specific, not industry-specific. So it has given me the chance and the opportunity to really explore the landscape of various businesses. Prior to Oakley, I started doing nonprofit healthcare consulting while I was still in grad school. And then when I transitioned into corporate, I started at Taco Bell, then moved into financial services industry with New Century, jumped into retail with PacSun, and now I'm with Oakley, and that's a company that crosses a lot of different industries.
Well, I can't see any trend at all in those companies. They're all so different. How are they similar?
It's been so exciting. Oh my gosh, they're all similar because they all have people.
and that's it. That's where it stops, huh?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's great. So, tell us about your role at Oakley. I mean, that is a mouthful of a title. You know, the Director of Global Talent Management and Retail HR. I'm not sure what retail HR means.
So, here I head up the global talent and organizational development functions worldwide. So in my role, I have the opportunity to engage with all of our nearly 6,000 employees around the world, working on things from leadership development to org design to talent management, and that allows me to get in country and in region with these teams and really explore and experience firsthand, you know, what they're going through and the cultural differences and implications of and nuances of what's happening in their offices. The retail HR side is just as it sounds. We have a retail division, and so it's the HR folks that support that division.
Now, you know, you're so many of the time when we talk about HR people, we think of the groups that is the group or the function that has to do with regulatory sort of monitoring. Mm-hmm. But that's not what you're into at all, really, is it?
No, not at all. So this is, you know, if you think about that as more of kind of the people operations side, I mean, they do really, really necessary work for organizations, and we really couldn't, you know, we'd struggle to get by without them. They have knowledge that I don't bring. What I bring is more of the strategy side of people. And so what motivates people, how do we get after developing leaders and succession planning? So if the head of our company leaves, who's best suited to take that job next? And are we really prepared for that to happen? And if we're not, what are we doing to get ready? And, you know, those kinds of conversations. If there's a change happening in the organization, have we considered the people implications to the change? Because it's easy to change technologies. I'm simplifying it for sure, but, you know, you kind of can flip the switch and the technology can change, but people respond to change very differently. And so have we really thought through the process of how we're going to bring people along in that experience? And if we're integrating with in some regions we've integrated with our parent company, you know, what have we done to really consider the people implications of that?
Okay, so, you know, I can't imagine there's anybody listening that hasn't heard of Oakley, but on the other hand, so many of us don't really have a grasp on all the things that Oakley's involved in. So tell us a little bit about Oakley itself.
I would love to. It's such a fantastic brand. So Oakley is really a design and innovation brand that's rooted in sport, and it was really founded on the idea that everything in this world can and will be made better. So in 1975, Jim Gennard founded the company, and a lot of people might think that we started with eyewear, since that's what we're most known for, but in fact that was not Oakley's first product. Our first product was a grip for a bike, and he invented a technology that ended up being what the grip was made out of. And that same technology can be found on our sport eyewear, both on the nose piece and in the ear stem today. And what happens is it actually, as you sweat, it gets tacky, not where you can feel it, but it stops it from moving. And so today we have over 600 patents, and we're most famed for our superior lens technologies, which are in all of our eyewear and goggles. And even though most people know us for our eyewear, we have extended our leadership position into apparel, footwear, and accessories.
And how broad is your market? You talk about global. I mean, I frankly hadn't realized that Oakley was global. So,
absolutely, yeah. We're in all of the major regions that most companies do business in. We have offices in Sao Paulo, Brazil, Montreal, Melbourne, Australia. We have Shanghai, Tokyo, Zurich, London. And those are just the offices that have decent amount of people in them. There's a lot of other people spread around the world. We're doing business in over 100 countries.
Wow. Okay, so before we dive in, Jennifer, there's a question. I had mentioned it to you before that we ask all of our guests that share with us sort of a particular experience or a key lesson that you've learned that sort of has guided you in business and in dealing with people.
Mm-hmm. You know, I really thought about this, and, you know, I was thinking, gosh, what could I come up with that's really profound? But I kept coming back to an experience that I share with a lot of people that work for me on my teams and as I'm teaching in classes and things like that. And the one experience that just I have carried with me and weighs on me still to this day is in a former company, I won't get into which company it was, but I was pressured, this was, you know, earlier on, I was pressured to manage someone out on my team that I really didn't feel we gave a fair chance to succeed to. And I've never been able to let go of that feeling. I've never been able to let go of that moment where I feel like I didn't fight hard enough. I didn't stand up for that person. And it's really caused me to become an even stronger advocate for my team and for employees in the company.
You know, I don't know you that well, but what little contact I've had with you, I can't imagine you being pressured into doing anything you don't believe in anymore.
I think that's true today. I've learned a lot. This is early on, right? And you're very impressionable early on, and you feel like your job is on the line and things like that. And, you know, I've learned a lot. I've grown.
I think that, you know, I'm glad you brought that up. I've not heard that before in the 6 years of asking guests this question. That's a new one, but I think it's probably also a common issue. It's just one people haven't thought to share. So thank you for sharing that with us.
Sure.
Well, look, when I first met you, you were given a presentation on neural leadership, which was a brand new term to me. Share with our audience, what is neural leadership?
Yeah, this is such an exciting field because it's so new. Neuroleadership is really uniting the world's foremost neuroscientists, leadership researchers, and organizational practitioners with the purpose of transforming how we think, develop, and perform. It's an emerging field of study that's focused on bringing neuroscientific knowledge into the areas of leadership development, management training, change management, education, consulting, coaching, kind of all the things that we play in, the sandbox that we play in as leadership practitioners. It's really exciting. I mean, it's really only because of an advancement that happened in the neuroleadership field or in the neuroscience field, where now the MRI machine has advanced to the fMRI machine, so the functional MRI machine, which allows them, the neuroscientists, to see what's happening in your brain while it's actually happening, as opposed to taking pictures of the brain, right? And so that technology combined with some other technologies really has, I mean, leaped us forward in terms of being able to understand the triggers for us.
Now, you know, some of that explanation sounds like it belongs in the research labs, but yet I know you're a very practical person and you're talking about what can you learn that you can apply in the real world. How does the research work its way into, you know, everyday leadership issues?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what's happening is we are, from the field of leadership, we're able to, there's lots of things that we have had a lot of theories about, right? We've theorized around what motivates people, how people make decisions, whether leaders can be, are born or made. You know, is there a difference between senior leaders and people who have not made it to senior ranks? What, you know, what happens when there's a conflict? You know, there's lots of, you can find, you can Google any one of those topics or look it up on Amazon, and, you know, a number of books will come up with people's theories based in maybe their own experience or something they've done in a company. And but what this is doing is actually taking the questions that we've held for a long time in leadership and into the lab, where neuroscientists are creating studies and running tests and creating situations or simulations that are triggering these types of, you know, emotional or social responses to things that they can then say, okay, this is actually what's happening. And then we can take that back into the field of leadership and say, okay, now that we know what the brain triggers are, or how people respond to different things, or what motivates people, or what happens in conflict, or how important social currency is, right? Now that we know that, we can construct an environment and teach people how to be leaders that get the most productivity out of people.
Okay, interesting. So you sort of start with the end result of how people are behaving. You back up into what is the neurological basis for that behavior, which then gives you information to then maybe apply it to working differently to avoid that behavior or to reinforce that behavior if it's good? Is that
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what's happening with the science part is that it's really hardening up something that traditionally businesses may have seen as the soft stuff, right? So it's no longer soft. This is real science. And so when you start talking about biologically, this is what's happening, it's more practical. People can understand it, and people, I think, are more bought into it.
So any specifics in terms of research that's been done and how it's been applied that you can share with us?
Yeah, for sure. There's tons of findings and research. There's still more questions than there are answers. If there's any grad students out there listening, get involved in this field. This is, man, to be a grad student today, it would be amazing because you can really make a name for yourself right now. But perhaps one of the most marketed pieces of research is from the work of David Rock, and so I'll just talk about that because I think it's a good entry into the field, and okay. It's really on his SCARF model. So to, you know, kind of summarize it and give you enough to at least interest your the listeners to want to learn more, our brain operates on a continuum of threat and reward. So threat, when we're in a state of threat, we want to move away from something, the situation or the person that's in front of us. When we're in a state of reward, we want more of that. We want to move toward that person or that situation, right? We have a positive feeling that's happening from our brain. And we're constantly scanning the environment for clues that put us somewhere on this threat and reward continuum. And, you know, there are two parts of our brain that are involved in this or intimately impacted by this, our amygdala and our prefrontal cortex. So our amygdala is our mission control for emotions. It's what's kind of monitoring how we're feeling in the moment and monitoring our emotional state. The prefrontal cortex is the executive part of our brain. This is the part of our brain that we need access to in order to do things like solve complex problems, think creatively, have a broader perspective, move things into long-term memory, right? It's not necessarily where those things all happen, but you can't do them without having access to this part of your brain. The issue is that these two parts of our brain are inversely related. What that means is that when the amygdala is triggered or activated, so we're having some emotional response to something, we're emotionally charged, our ability to access that executive part of our brain, that prefrontal cortex, is severely inhibited. And vice versa, when our amygdala is quiet, then we have full access to our prefrontal cortex. So this is where SCARF comes in. SCARF is the acronym for the five brain cravings that humans have. And the research has been done across, you know, socioeconomic levels and genders and ethnicities and cultures. So this is not a Western, research concept, right? So this is a human, this is about humans. And so we all have these five brain cravings. They are the levers that control the state of threat or reward that we're in. So said differently, the degree to which these brain cravings are met or are not met is correlated to the amount of threat or reward that we're in. And remember, when you're in threat, you start shutting down your ability to really think clearly. So what is SCARF? SCARF is, again, stands for these five brain cravings. The S is status, C is certainty, A is autonomy, R is relatedness, and F is fairness. So let me just give you like a one sentence on each of these. Status is a perceived sense of status. This could be triggered by socioeconomic conditions. It could be the result of a title difference, tenure, gender, the size of your house, the car you drive. I mean, there's lots of things that can trigger a status imbalance for people. Certainty. Our brains are prediction machines. We like to know what's going to happen. We don't wake up in the morning and instinctively hope that we know less about our future or our stability, right?
Yeah.
Autonomy is also perceived. It's a perceived sense of choice. You may or may not have actually had a choice, or the choice may have been controlled. But if you feel like you had a choice or a say in the situation, then that craving would be met for you. Relatedness is friend or foe, trust or distrust. And then fairness is something that you know it when you feel it. It's something that's not tangible, right? But it's this feeling that you have when a situation feels unfair, and it's probably highly correlated to your belief system. So let me give you a business example.
If I can just for a minute.
Yeah.
These don't really match up with Maslow's hierarchies of needs. This is something different, isn't it?
Yeah, it's different. So what Maslow suggested is that the way humans are motivated is that they have this base level motivation that is, the kind of safety and security needs. And then as you move up his hierarchy, you get into then these ideas of social belongingness and ultimately to self-actualization. And so his theory suggests that unless the base needs are met, then you're not motivated to achieve or get after these needs that you have that are more social in nature. It's a really interesting theory and obviously a widely held and longstanding theory. The issue is that this neuroscience research is now actually suggesting that Maslow is wrong. And so a major piece of research that is contradicting Maslow is that what they found is that the parts of our brain that are stimulated when you feel kind of social pain, so this feeling of rejection, when they create that feeling in someone by leaving them out of something, and there's these great studies that they've done of people in brain scanners where they've created this feeling in them and watched what regions of their brain lit up. They're the exact same regions of the brain that also lit up when someone was inflicted with physical pain. So what that means is that our brain doesn't differentiate between the two. It processes physical pain and social pain in the same way. And so Maslow suggests that there's a hierarchy in the way that we process those and the way that we're motivated to achieve that, but the brain science is actually telling us that's actually not true. And if you think about even the way that we talk about social pain, we use very physical terms, right? My heart is breaking. Right? You really talk about it as if it's physical, and we can feel others' social pain. right? So it's a really interesting moment in time in terms of a lot of theories that are, in some cases, we're validating things that we knew, but we didn't understand why it was so. And in other ways, we're finding really completely new research. Let me give you a quick business example around scarves, because I think it might help just drive it home. If I said to an employee that I have feedback for you about a meeting we just walked out of, and so, you know, meet me in my office next Tuesday at 2. What I did is I unintentionally created a situation where that employee is in threat, and they're not going to be able to perform at the level of higher order thinking that they're capable of. They're not going to be as creative, solving as complex of problems, bringing the broad perspective that they normally bring between now and next Tuesday at 2, and maybe even a little bit longer than that, but for sure between now and next Tuesday. And the reason is because I've compromised their brain cravings. In terms of status, I told them I'm giving them feedback. So I raised my status and I lowered theirs. This is me giving it to you, right? I'm above you. Around certainty, I didn't give them any sense of what will happen next Tuesday at 2. They don't even know if they're going to have a job when they leave that day. Autonomy, I didn't ask them if they wanted feedback. I didn't give them a choice. I didn't even ask them what time is good for them. Relatedness, they're now questioning this trust that they had built with me. They thought they had built with me, and so the situation is feeling unfair. So in this situation, my intention does not match my impact. My intention might even be to have just an open conversation, or the feedback could be positive. But the impact is that I've triggered that person's amygdala. I've given them this emotional charge that's going to carry with them, and they're going to be operating with limited access to the kind of executive part of their brain over the next week. So this is an example of something that probably all of us have either heard or have said to someone in, you know, not meaning any harm, just in passing. We make comments like this, but drawing awareness to the impact of what a simple statement could do in terms of someone's productivity is, I think, really important.
You know, as sort of a side issue on this, Jennifer, the thought just went through my mind. Is the impact that this example has limited by age? In other words, in dealing with younger children or younger people, does the same level of anxiety get created in these kinds of situations?
Absolutely. Yeah. And so you can think in parenting of situations where, you know, just by the way that you say things, puts them on the defensive, and they, you know, can't, you know, why did you do that, right? It triggers this, you know, oh my gosh, I'm in defensive mode and I can barely even think right now response. And so it's not age specific. In fact, there are neuroscientists that are specifically working on how to integrate this type of research into schools.
So this is not a learned pattern. This is a neurological pattern.
It is. However, I will say that you can go on to, it used to be myscarf360.com. I think if you still type that in, then it'll take you to the new website. I can't remember what they renamed the website, but you can take an online assessment. It takes about 2 minutes to take it. It's very, very short, and it will give you it's free. It will give you your rank order of the five, and for some people, they're evenly weighted, and for some people, there's one that triggers them more than others, but all of them will trigger us maybe just to different degrees, and I think that part is a little bit learned, right? So Okay. Maybe you've, in your life, been in a lot of ambiguous situations, and you've had to figure out how to work through ambiguity regularly, then you might be slightly less triggered with a lack of certainty than, or maybe it takes more uncertainty to trigger you than it would someone else, right, who maybe everything has been laid out for them their whole life. So there are degrees that are differences in people, but the five exist.
Okay, so we've all got sort of these five levers that can be triggered, but given our experiences and our maybe even our physical makeup, how easily they're triggered or how we react to them being triggered will be different from one person to another.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, it's so exciting. I love this field.
I can't tell at all. I just want to interrupt and tell the audience, Jennifer does not speak slow, and she's
got a lot
of information to share. I love it, and she's passionate about it. We're recording this. It will be available online next week. So I know there's already things I want to go back and hear again, and I'm sure other people are thinking the same thing. So enjoy the ride. Don't worry about keeping up.
My apologies.
No, I say that as a compliment. I love your passion for this subject, Jennifer. So, okay, so that's a model. That's a specific piece of research. We can see how it can impact the most casual of conversations. How do you start to, how do you apply that, or in general, or even at Oakley specifically?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. There's so much, because this is just one tiny, you know, I mean, big, important model, but one piece of research, and there's research happening in lots of different areas that relate to organizations and leadership. So the ability to apply this is so big. At Oakley, we've done a lot to integrate much of this research, starting with educating leaders at all levels. We have done a significant amount of training around SCARF, and we've really begun the muscle building on how to apply it to onboarding, performance discussions, change management, feedback, and lots of other people-related activity. I mean, if you think about just, you know, onboarding, for example, you say, okay, what might be triggered for someone during onboarding? Well, relatedness certainly, you know, stands out as something that is, it could easily trigger a threat response in someone when they're brand new to an organization. And so what can we do to create relatedness for someone right away? Find things that they have in common with other people in the company and say, oh, you like that sports team? This person over here, they like that too. And start creating relatedness for someone that's brand new to an organization. Because it is daunting when you join. You don't know anyone. You hope that someone's going to, you know, want to have lunch with you, and you're not going to be sitting there by yourself, and you just, it's a completely new environment that you have to learn, you know, how everything operates there and being the new person. And so really paying attention to the onboarding experience and how do you really satisfy cravings during that situation. Change management, right? So one of the things that we have done is worked with a couple different groups that were going through different degrees of change, but both pretty significant. And what we asked them to do, we particularly worked with the managers and leaders of this group, and we asked them to identify what's happening for you right now. What's going on for you? What's the water cooler talk? What are the things that are on your mind that are concerning you? And write all of those down. And then set those aside, and then we teach them about SCARF. And then we bring those back, and we say, let's map all of those things that you just said to SCARF. How many of those things are status-related? How many are certainty related, right? Autonomy related, and so forth. Then we end up with a picture of what's happening for them. Are they being most triggered by the lack of certainty, or is it the lack of autonomy or fairness, right? Then we have a map, and we can say, great, now we can figure out how do we lead through this. Because your teams are probably feeling something very similar, right? So how do we get this, satisfy these for you, and how do we get you you know, kind of in a position where you can lead others through these feelings that they're probably happening? How do we get you more certainty or get you more autonomy, right? In the areas that you're going to be able to have them. You're not going to have a choice on everything and every change. But if we can find the areas that we can give people that choice or that piece of autonomy, then we're certainly going to be, you know, miles ahead of where we would have been.
You know, as you're talking about this, I mean, I can certainly see the application in onboarding, that we can look at this and make some assumptions about almost anybody that we bring into the company. What are their concerns going to be, and what you know, and how do we handle that?
Mm-hmm.
And sort of the same thing in change management. But what about day-to-day leadership? What about the manager who's, you know, daily managing people, constant issues, constant questions, constant stress? How does this help them?
Yeah.
How do they apply?
So, there's other pieces of research that are probably more applicable to that question. However, what I will say, just in keeping with this a little bit of this research, and then I'll bring in a tiny bit of other research, is traditionally what a lot of companies do in terms of, let me just get, I'm going to do a circular answer to your question. is that they have this performance management process where once a year, leaders, or maybe twice a year, leaders have these performance discussions, right? And they're time-bound, and you have to have them on a certain date, and you might fill out a self-appraisal, and then they fill out an appraisal, and then, you know, this conversation may or may not take place. And what we have found, and probably where we've gone the deepest in implementing a lot of the neuroleadership, is taking a more progressive approach to performance management. Now, David Rock has an article out there called Kill Your Ratings, I think, something like that. And it's one piece of multiple pieces of research that are really getting after how negative the traditional process of performance management can be on leaders and on employees. And so we have really taken that to heart and gotten rid of traditional forms, ratings, the bureaucracy, it being an HR-managed process, if you will, and really said, what if we trained leaders on how to have really good dialogue, how to really talk to people on an ongoing basis, how to equip them to be better day-to-day leaders with their teams? And so what we've done here is thrown all of the traditional stuff out. We have no paper. No one turns anything in. Ever throughout the year. And instead, what we expect leaders to have are ongoing, meaningful conversations with employees regularly. And they're not events. It's about capitalizing on the times that you're already with your employees, when they're already in front of you. You have touch bases. You might go to grab coffee, you know, hey, oh, you want to go to lunch today? Great. Don't miss out on that opportunity to say, how are you? What's going on for you? What can I do for you, right? And so not all leaders have been taught how to have these conversations and are comfortable doing it. And so what we're doing is putting a lot of energy into equipping leaders with this, and then we're measuring the percentage of employees that are having ongoing meaningful conversations. And so we're asking employees throughout the year via a pulse survey, have you had a meaningful conversation with your boss in the last, 90 days or whatever, we decide the time period is. So not only this is our third year doing this, not only have we seen those numbers go up in the pulse survey, we've actually also seen it transfer into our engagement survey. And so we do an engagement survey with our parent company every other year. And so from 2011 to 2013, the score on the question that asks, my boss gives me regular, honest feedback, or, I can't remember exactly how it's worded, but that's the gist of it. That score for Oakley, which is the only brand within Luxottica that was doing this, went up 9 points. That's a huge increase on an engagement survey for that item. And so we didn't just see it on the pulse survey, but we saw that transfer over to our engagement survey, which is telling us that what we're doing is working, right? It's really resonating with people.
Now, let me drill down a little on that. So Oakley as a company, you know what the score, the impact of this change in performance management system has done.
Yeah.
Do you track it back to individual leaders, individual departments, so that you then got feedback for, let's say, a department head that you probably aren't doing a good job on having these kind of conversations?
Yeah. So at the engagement survey level, we do that. We can see that level of data. On the pulse survey, we've opted not to. And that's a conscious choice we made. Easily, we could change the way that we collect the data and be able to drill down. What we've decided is that we in no way want to use this punitively. Rather, this is about a directional cultural change for us. We want to become a environment that this is happening regularly. And so for us, we track it at the functional head level. So each of the direct reports to the CEO, and then it gives my team information on where do we need to amp up our communication and development of leaders. What are the areas that maybe it's a functional area within, but maybe it's a consistent theme across? Because we ask on the pulse survey, have you had a meaningful conversation with your boss in the last 90 days? Or let's say that's the number. Now remember, meaningful is defined by the employee, not the boss. So right. A boss might think they're having a meaningful conversation, but the employee might not think it was meaningful. So that's important. But also, after that question, we ask, if they answer yes, we say, what made it meaningful? And if they answer no, what would have made it meaningful? We don't have to answer that, but we do get a fair number of responses to those questions. And so the people that talk about what could have made it meaningful, it's really important in really architecting what we do next in terms of continuing to, again, build this muscle in the organization.
Yeah, because as a practical matter, I mean, we've got... So you educate all the leaders in this. They all understand it. They've all been through whatever training you're offering. But then some of them are more inclined to be people-oriented. Some of them may be more inclined to be in wanting to spend time with their discipline that they're trained in and less on leadership types of things. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think it's the exception, not the rule. So on our most recent survey, we had a 93% response rate, and our percentage of people that said yes was 90. So most people are having, I mean, it's a huge response rate. So we're pretty confident this is representative of the company. Most people are having meaningful conversations. This has been a 3-year effort of really leading people. Now, for those exceptions, we hear about them. So even though we don't drill down to the individual manager level on the pulse survey, we hear about them. Their employees, come talk to us and say, my boss isn't doing this, or they might go to HR, or whatever the case is. You can only hide for so long, right? Because we haven't just been educating leaders on this being the process. We've educated individual contributors that you should expect this. This is an expectation.
What really stuck with me that you've said here, Jennifer, is this is not a management training topic. This is a cultural change for the company.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, absolutely. I don't mean to imply that it's a change for Oakley, but it is.
No. Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I agree with you. No, yeah.
Okay. Which is huge. I mean, changing culture is obviously the ideal end result because now you don't have to micromanage it. But it's also obviously the most difficult thing to do is to make a cultural change of established companies, established ways of doing things, people's preconceived ideas that I'm entitled to review. How do you know how to give me a raise if you aren't giving me reviews and so forth?
Yeah, absolutely. So really also teaching leaders how to do that. How do you figure out what their compensation is at the end of the year, right? So what is the process for that? How do you determine that? So really educating, on that piece. But we moved from, when we launched this, the first survey we did, we had about a 60% yes. And so to go to 90%, I mean, we're pretty happy with the improvement that we've seen, and do feel really strongly that there's nothing in it for individual contributors to say yes when they're not getting it. Right. So
right.
I feel pretty strongly, and the correlation on the engagement survey that we are absolutely heading in the right direction.
Now, this has been a huge, I'm going to say, change management philosophy here in terms of impacting your performance management system, all based upon this research in neural leadership. Have you done anything else of a similar scale in the company?
The big things that we have done, I mean, the change management stuff is huge. And then also the way that we onboard, we've completely revamped our onboarding from, doing what a lot of kind of, oftentimes orientation is interchanged with the word onboarding, but they are two different things. Orientation is an event, right? Onboarding is much longer. It's a process. And so we really went from orientation to onboarding and how do we create relatedness. And I think there's companies that probably do this really well, but we were, you know, we were just okay at it. And so we assign you now a comrade when you start, and it's not even someone in your direct function, it's someone outside your function, so that you start to get to know people across functions and build that network, and really someone that you can reach out to and, you know, create that relatedness, give you certainty. I mean, we give you, you know, lots of, we try to fulfill a lot of that in the way that we even onboard. We've really changed a lot in just some of our practices. Almost everything we do, we also have changed the way that we train. So there's a model that is the acronym AGES, and so I don't have time to get into, you know, exactly what all that is, but I recommend reading about it. But AGES is the way to, is based in neuroscience, the way humans learn. And so if you follow the AGES model, you're going to have better retention and better learning from your trainings. And so we have really revamped these, you know, 8-hour day types of workshops and things like that into really following more of an AGES approach, and you know, constructing learning in the way that the brain actually takes in information. So I think the performance management is such a great one to talk about because I can give you really tangible results, but the way that we're just getting after work in general is all being redesigned around neuroleadership. I think the other thing that I will say is I've implemented just the philosophy around people and learning and development here. What, you know, I've really done is instituted this mantra that we call You Drive. And so it's not mandatory for you to go to a training or to show up at, you know, a development session or whatever. You drive. You choose to engage in, you know, growing your career, in developing yourself, in seeking out feedback, and, you know, being a part of, you know, the social events and things like that. You choose that. We'll provide the vehicles. You drive, though. And so just that even vernacular and that approach, where a lot of times it's like, oh, if you're a new leader, you have to go to new leader training. Nope. You drive. But if you choose not to, it could negatively impact you in the end because you might not end up being as good of a leader in building the skills, right? All of that will wash out. We believe all of that will wash out in the end, right? Okay. But you drive and you make choices that will impact you long term.
So, you know, I'm so glad that we had these last few minutes here because you've really, and I appreciate you taking the time to use the performance management as an example of how to apply neuroleadership. But I'm glad you caught me in making sure that the audience understands that that's just a narrow piece of what you're doing. Mm-hmm. You're talking about onboarding. You're talking about change management. You're talking about mm-hmm. performance management. You're talking about mm-hmm. training. You're talking about the U-Drive program. Mm-hmm. This is a total cultural impact you're having on the company is the way I'm hearing.
Complete 180 in how we get after people and people development. And it has been so well received. That's and the change great. Management part, I mean, we created our brain-friendly approach to change management. What is the model to get after that we can then teach even leaders on how do you even manage it on small scale changes that you might not engage OD on, right?
Okay. Well, look, we're sort of running to the end of our time here, Jennifer. How does someone learn more about neuroleadership? I mean, I have been so fascinated with this topic and collected so much stuff. I haven't even had time to read it all since I first met you. But how does someone learn more about it?
Yeah, so there's two things that I'll throw out there. One is the Neuroleadership Institute. It's neuroleadership.com. So neuroleadership.com. That is a great first step. It is the leading global research organization and also the pioneer of bringing the fields of neuroscience and leadership together. It's run, founded by David Rock, who's really the pioneer of neuroleadership. So there are other people working now, researchers in this field, but the Neuroleadership Institute has really brought this collection of research and folks together. And so start with their website. They have lots of resources on there and can point you in a lot of directions. Secondly, for anyone that happens to be local, and I'm not sure how actually widespread your listeners are, but I actually did found and lead the Orange County chapter of the Neuroleadership Institute. And so we meet quarterly. We actually had a meeting today, and it is a content-based group. It is not a networking group. It's content-based, and it is about people who are fascinated with this field, want to learn more, you know, want to try to integrate it and make it practical, and we just talk about a different piece of the research each quarter, and really what do we do with that, and how do we integrate that into companies. So anyone can reach out to me. I'm on LinkedIn. Feel free to shoot me a message.
So to find out more about the group that you lead, we should go to LinkedIn and look for you?
Yeah.
Or does the group have a site?
Yep, we don't have a site. It's kind of, we're going through an identity crisis with the Neuroleadership Institute a little bit right now, but my group is strong and growing. I mean, it's just really taken off, and it's so exciting. I mean, today we had, so many new people. Every meeting is just more and more new people. It's fantastic. So there is not a website, I'm sorry, but if you connect with me on LinkedIn, ask me about the local chapter, I'm happy to send you the information and add you to the distribution list.
Great. And that's the best way for people to follow up with you is through your LinkedIn profile?
It is, yeah.
Okay. Anything else that you want to throw in that I kind of talked over or that you didn't get a chance to discuss before we wrap this up?
I don't think so. I just am so grateful for you carving out the time to allow me to spread the word on neuroleadership. I really do feel that we're at an inflection point and we've been at this point for a long time, but no one's been able to figure out how to get out of it and how to move forward. And I think that this field of neuroleadership is cracking the code on what's next. I mean, I think it's so exciting.
Well, it is fascinating. There is a lot of material on it. I was amazed at how prolific David Rock is. There's a lot of material out there that I've browsed through that found really, I could understand it. Let's put it that
Absolutely,
way.
Absolutely, yeah.
It didn't leave me behind. So
yeah.
Thank you very much for joining us today. Thank you for sharing your passion about this. Thank you for sharing your experience at Oakley and what it's doing to the culture there, which is obviously a sterling example of how powerful this can be. And welcome to the Coaching Perspective radio community.
Thank you so much.
Great. Have a great evening, Jennifer.
You too.
All right. Have a great evening. I hope that what we've provided you is new information and ideas that you can put to use immediately to identify and achieve your goals. Thank you.
You've been listening to the one show that takes a look at business from a different perspective. The Coaching Perspective with Master Certified Business Coach, Doug DeFeller.